So what was the big item on the agenda?
Well, I don't know that yesterday. We had a lot of big items. We did, speaking of red flag warnings, we did have Brandon Myers in, the emergency manager, kind of gave us a bird's eye view, overview of the Cottonwood fire and that that entire challenge.
Still getting flare-ups within
the
fire?
Yeah, we are. And he did make note that the what they call the complex team, the SIM team, that's compiled of, you know, federal and state and local resources and equipment of all types, including aircraft, which are, you know, key when you can get them in the air. They've got a what they call Type 2 team that's been reassigned to oversee Cottonwood and Morrill and others. And they basically have put now, Corey, strike teams in various locations throughout the state of Nebraska. I think there's one at Broken Bow, down in Columbus.
That are just ready to respond to anything that flares up.
Right. Yep. And because we have such a heavy presence still here in North Platte and Ogallala, they weren't identified as another strike force point. But we have those resources here, including Black Hawk helicopters and some fixed-wing aircraft. And so, yeah, there are flare-ups continuing. Looking back, Brandon noted that this Cottonwood fire started March 12th in the mid-afternoon. He notified me through Joanna Lemoyne, his assistant, to we needed to put the ball rolling to sign a declaration, emergency declaration, which triggers the process to get state resources and beyond.
Right.
And that's something we do typically, whomever is chair at the time, and we have an event like this, we get those signed immediately, and it's better late than better to be early than late. And if we don't need it, we don't need it. Those resources don't end up being called upon. It's no big deal, but it is a big deal if we need those resources immediately, and it also impacts the cost to the local tax base.
Sure.
So we get help with that cost-wise in the backside of those events. So it's something we always do. But Brandon did note that we're down to, you know, just a few hot spots in Cottonwood, and the Black Hawks were taking care of those over the weekend and dropping copious amounts of water. They're trying to finally get those extinguished. I don't know the status of those now, but it's well underway to keep those contained. That effort's been ongoing here, obviously, for 2.5 to 3 weeks. It's been crazy. We did lose, according to Brandon, 3 houses completely lost. 2 additional houses were damaged, plus numerous and unaccounted for outbuildings, barn sheds that they don't have a tally on yet. Livestock-wise, they honestly haven't had any feedback on cattle numbers. So I'm hopeful that a lot of those cattle were still close by in calving season and places where, you know, the producers didn't have to go out and gather them up in a section pasture and could get them out of harm's way. Unfortunately, it sounds like we did have a sheep herd that was fairly decimated. Some big losses there, and but the numbers are all over the place, from maybe 100 up to 400 or 500. I don't know that number specifically, and I'm not sure Brandon does either. But as he pointed out, thank the Lord, was no loss of life in the Cottonwood fire. That's always number one and paramount when they do these things. And boy, a lot of brave fire people and citizens that put themselves in harm's way to stop this thing and contain it, and pretty scary stuff when the wind shifts in all 4 directions in a matter of 30 minutes when you get these fires. You know, the turmoil within the fire, they create their own, literally create their own weather. And so you can be safe right now, and 5 minutes you can be in the middle of a firestorm, literally in the middle. And that happened to some of the folks that were down there in Cottonwood that shared stories about that. And so at any rate, the good Lord willing, that the Cottonwood fire is well under control. Our big concern obviously now, and you know, our fire resources are staying in the areas, because we all know it's another one could happen any place, any time. Dry lightning, for example, that started some of the secondary fires up in Grant County.
Yeah.
You know, you never know, Corey. I mean, and it could be not necessarily negligence of, you know, somebody throwing a cigarette out along the highway or something like that, which is unfortunate that that happens way too often. But nevertheless, whatever the source, we have to be diligent and be very, very careful, because the next one could be, you know, literally over the next hill. You never know.
Yeah, you don't. We, and the I-80 fire broke out last week, too, right, south of Paxton, right. And that's just an example. And,
it is. And I don't know what the source of that was, but you draw conclusions on your own, whether, you know, not educated conclusions, but first thing that you think of is, did somebody throw a cigarette out along the interstate? Yeah. I don't know. I live fairly close to Highway 83 in northern Lincoln County, and I can tell you over the years, the times I've approached the highway at night and saw a vehicle flip a lit cigarette out into the ditch, because you can see it glows like...
I've,
you know, like a flare.
Too. Yeah.
And it's, people just don't think about it, unfortunately.
So you had that, and then you also, with that, discussed, and I'm guessing you authorized your emergency manager to attend the IAEM conference this November?
Yeah, I think that's an international, it has an international flavor to it. He's been there before, and they just do a lot of orientations and trainings and roundtables and share experience. And we kind of teased him. It's like, well, there won't be any, it won't be 40 below in Long Beach that time of year, and shouldn't be any brush fires there in the next to the ocean. So Long Beach isn't too far from Laguna. And they can go down on the beach and hopefully not engage in any kind of wildfire nonsense there.
Tell them not to send any pictures or social media videos or anything to make you jealous.
None of that, but boy, he needs a break. And it's really not a break. It's, you know, he picks something up from attending these type things each year. Brandon is a very proactive emergency manager. We're really blessed to have him here. He's good at anticipating the next issue, and one of the reasons he's so good at that is because he does attend a lot of these kind of type workshops, and he absorbs a lot of information, and he typically brings back something that tunes up how we do our thing here.
It's kind of how you get smart is to go to a lot of meet with a lot of different people from a lot of different parts of the country.
Correct.
And find out what they've dealt with, and then you just store that knowledge away in case you need it, and
exactly.
It comes in handy usually. So
yeah. So needless to say, you know, Brandon's not doing any R&R anytime soon. He's still front and center on our diligence on fire prevention and mitigation if it does happen.
How the discussed and consider animal control interlocal agreement? How'd that come out?
Well, we didn't. We tabled that again. Put it on the agenda just because I didn't want to let it get stale. And Commissioners Hughley and Bruns were to kind of work out some of the details on as far as identifying the responsibilities for costs and so forth, so that we didn't put the animal shelter or the veterinarian that they retain or contract with to provide services for both, well, wherever the animal comes from, rural or urban. But that was kind of the sticky wicket last year, Corey, with some of that. It was like identifying where the animal came from, and then some fairly substantial vet bills that came thereafter. So they just simply didn't have a chance to go over some of those things that they wanted to see addressed, and so we tabled that. Hopefully, you know, to their credit, Chief Reeves and the city folks are still accommodating, you know, the animal shelter still accommodates rural animals, takes them in if necessary. So we're kind of just on a handshake agreement at this point. So we need to get that finalized soon.
Okay. So that'll come back?
Yeah, it'll be back.
What about receiving bids for the asphaltic concrete paving project?
Yeah, that we'll see how this spike in energy impacts those bidding prices. Mm-hmm. This focus, the one-year focus, one of the big ones was Hershey Dickens South and in the North Hershey Road. And because of proximity, the highway superintendent suggested we submit those bids in a tag team fashion so that they can be considered in either, parcel one, parcel two, A and B, or this portion done, say late summer 26, and maybe part B is finished up in the spring of 27, giving it some latitude, because we can carry over from one fiscal year to the next with our budgeting because of the bonding. That project could be, it's estimated to be somewhere in the $3.85 million range. Pretty aggressive project there in the Hershey Dickens project. And typically, what jams you up on budgeting, Corey, is if when you roll a big project and each year our paving project on our 1 year is gobbles up a tremendous amount of money. And it always, we're always cognizant of the fact we need to keep it within the budget cycle, or it really impacts when you reappropriate. So this gives us some latitude with the bonding, that the funding will be through the bonding. So that's going to allow that to be protracted as far as the timelines, and it may give us relief as far as who bids and how pricey those bids are, because they're going to have a longer window of opportunity to complete the contract.
Okay. So instead of having to complete it in a calendar year, then you can, if they don't get it all finished, then it can carry over to the
Correct.
Following spring?
Correct. And it's not really calendar year, it's fiscal year. So
fiscal year.
Yep. So you're
and
talking
what is the county's
August,
fiscal year?
August to July.
Okay, August 1st through July 31st.
So, and it's the crazy way that budgets are done in Nebraska. The cities are different. Their timeline is different.
Mm-hmm.
But interestingly enough, we don't adopt our budget, set our levies, until we're almost 3 months into the year each year, and that's just the way the statute's drawn up. It's crazy. So you're kind of just betting on the money's going to be there when you start your budget. And we always have to caution our department heads, don't spend a lot of capital up front when we really don't know at the end of the day when we set these in September.
Keep things pretty tight until you get to the budget process.
By the way, it's just like your own budget. If the money hasn't come in yet with tax revenues, it's mm-hmm. really not there to spend yet.
Yeah.
So that's always something we struggle with.
Don't assume it's going to be covered.
But I think people are getting a better, as far mm-hmm. as our in-house education, I think the folks are getting mm-hmm. better acclimated to that, better understanding. County Treasurer's done a good job of that.
Mm-hmm. Did you approve the purchase of grader blades?
That's not a great big expenditure, but it is a necessary one.
Mm-hmm.
As anybody that's ever worked around front-end loaders or motor graders and all that, the grader blade is literally where the rubber meets the road. The blade itself on your mold board wears out, and you pull it off, you pitch it, and sell it for scrap, and you put a new one on. It's an extra hardened piece of material that protects your blade from excessive wear. That's once you identify that blade itself is worn down, you replace it. So it's a maintenance thing. I think one bid was $15,000 and change, and the other was $12,000 for some 7-footers and some 8-footers, and different machines have different length blades. And so they just brought it forward to ask our blessing on it, and they do a good job. We've got two local suppliers that typically bid those, and they came in really cheap for today's prices for steel in general. So about $12,000 we're going to have on that. They just always have to keep an inventory of that, because if you're doing road work, you're wearing them out.
Mm-hmm.
So
That'll happen.
That'll happen. Yeah.
Did Lisa with Visit North Platte come in and give you
the animal
report?
She did. I was teasing her. I said, you know, in the good old days, you used to bring in satchels full of $100 bills. You know, where's our take? And she kind of smiled and like, yeah, okay, I've heard that before. Tom Wolfgang is the chair of their Visit North Platte this year, and he came mm-hmm. along and they gave us a great comprehensive presentation of what's going on and showed us various charts on revenues and so forth. And I think in 2025 they had a slight increase in total lodging tax revenue, which mm-hmm. is, by the way, where they get their money. $1.3 million she shared with us, $1.3 million last year. And the year before was roughly $90,000 less than that. So the trend is still upward on revenue for lodging. And just a reminder to everyone that they are fully funded by lodging tax, which was created under a separate legislative endeavor mm-hmm. a number of years ago, which created these tourism boards.
Mm-hmm.
So no property tax, absolutely no property tax funds their operation. It all comes directly from lodging tax or travelers that come in and stay at a motel. And that's what pays their bills. So it was good to get that overview. And Lisa talked about some of the expansions they've done over the years with, you know, bringing, you know, some folks probably kind of think, well, the softball events and baseball events, soccer events are, you know, longstanding, but not necessarily. They've kind of cultivated those things. And now they're looking at things that Tom mentioned, even lacrosse tournaments perhaps, some other things that mm-hmm. they might be able to attract to North Platte. We've got a very good venue here. They've got a good base of lodging, restaurants, and sports facilities, lots of ball diamonds and soccer fields and that type of thing. So that helps. And so, yeah, Lisa gave us an annual kind of overview of yep. where they're at and where they're going. And the crane thing, we spent a little time talking about the crane and what a tremendous draw the crane yep. watching is. It's a big input for Lincoln County to have those folks come visit. And Lisa said, well, the stats say they only stay 2 days, but she said, I'm thinking they stay more like three or four because mm-hmm. they'll come into the visitor center a couple times during the week while they're out with the crane viewing thing. And they have the various tours, you know, they put people on the bus and take them out at daylight and at dusk and mm-hmm. when the cranes are moving in and out. And it's a pretty neat experience. Even the locals, as she points out, you know, a lot of the locals take it for granted, but maybe they should go out and take it in because it's something people travel for hundreds of miles to experience.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Okay, and then you had an application by Joshua and Renee Baird and Melvin Lake for the Baird Administrative Subdivision.
Yeah, that's a little bit of a housekeeping thing up on North Washboard, just north of town, mm-hmm. west of 83, and there's a couple lots out there that one of them needs some mitigation as far as its how it's identified as far as a legitimate residential facility and, mm-hmm. and some of the things that impact that as far as septic and so forth. And mm-hmm. I think that's part of what they're doing there is trying to separate that out to address that and segregate that parcel. You know, basically from our standpoint, Corey, is just a housekeeping thing. And
so did you take any action on
it? We did.
Then?
We approved it. Okay. Yeah. Planning and zoning, they as usually do all the heavy lifting.
Right.
Judy Clark went through it all and said, you know, she explains it all for us novices because we forget that stuff. But mm-hmm. walked us through it briefly and said, you know, everything's good. It's already been subdivided and we're simply dividing this parcel out and identifying two different property addresses. So it's, yeah.
Okay. And did you appoint a commissioner to the oversight committee?
Well, actually, I ended up with that. And that came, I had forgotten. I had a conversation with Jim Hawks, who's on the International Port of the Plains, and some weeks ago. And they had recognized early on, and they were trying to be proactive, which is says a lot about the people we have on that board.
Mm-hmm.
they recognize there could be some conflicts moving forward as far as, and, you know, built-in bias perhaps if they agree to a contract and somebody that's maybe involved in the port has a hand in that or plays a role in that. So they reached out to the accountability folks in Lincoln and posed the question, you know, do you think it would be in our best interest to create a quasi-committee of five, I think they identified five, that will have some representation from the port, but other people that are at arm's length with our operation and do not have any authority, will not vote on any contracts that we enter into. And they gave them their blessing. Their counsel penned a letter and said, I think that's an excellent idea. Go for it. So Jim approached me some time ago, and of course we've got a couple commissioners involved in the port as far as overseeing what's mm-hmm. going on, just, you know, hide and watch type things, you know, sit and listen.
Mm-hmm.
But we kind of bandied it about yesterday and said, you know, maybe two elements came to mind. Jim pointed out that I have a lot of experience dealing with the railroad and the logistics therein and subcontracting with third-party vendors, which I did help. Well, I did actually facilitate a rock distribution point with Martin Marietta some years ago at the mm-hmm. co-op I used to work for. And in addition, put together a biodiesel distribution point there on the railroad. So I do have some of that experience as far as dealing with those things, those challenges with the UP. And I'm not on the board. I don't regularly attend their, you know, their meetings. So I'm going to serve as one of those five that when the Port of the Plains has a potential contract with a vendor or whatever party it is, that we'll take a look at that and put a critical eye on it and say, okay, are we compromised here, otherwise compromised because somebody has a vested interest in this or a personal benefit, a personal gain, and those kind of things. So it's just another set of eyes to make sure that we're doing due diligence as far as making sure we're doing it on the up and up.
Okay. And at the beginning, I noticed you had a couple of resolutions for conditional use permits.
We formally adopted those conditional use permits that we had the hearings on last week.
Okay.
And that's the way those typically work, Corey. We have the public hearing. That's the opportunity for the public to speak either for or against those. Mm-hmm. Most of those don't have anyone rendering testimony other than the petitioners, the applicants.
Right.
These were essentially that. There were no folks in the room that protested these or had any concerns. And so once we closed the hearing last week and voted to approve, in-house counsel then drafts that resolution that identifies the whereases and therefores, and we officially adopt them the following week. So that's what we did with the Sundstrom conditional use program or proposal and the Huffman proposal.
Okay. So. Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
Well, I'll tell you the hot topic with the fires. I want to tell you there's a lot of conversation about evaluation mm-hmm. relief, and there's a form called a 422 that comes out of the Department of Revenue that you can pick a copy up at your local county assessor's office. And ironically, you have to get it from the assessor, I believe, but you file it with the county clerk officially if you file one. But what they are in a nutshell is you can petition the value of property. In this case, Corey, where the fire damage was, if you've had damage to structures, that would be something that would be pertinent to file a 422 on before mm-hmm. the end of June through the clerk. And I would encourage people to first talk to the county assessor in Lincoln County or Dawson County first before they go through the process. There are some folks out there trying to put together informational meetings, but I would say cut to the chase. I would strongly encourage property owners to go directly to the assessors now and ask those questions about what their loss was, because at the Brady briefing with Governor Pillen, I was there. Commissioner Bruns was in the room. This topic came up from someone in the audience, and I don't know if it was a Dawson County commissioner or who it was. It doesn't matter. But the 422 form was brought up that people should be taking a look at those. The governor looked back at us, seeking a little bit of input. I stepped forward, as well as Commissioner Bruns, and we made a few comments. Mine was to be cautious about your expectations, because we as commissioners in the Betty's Way fire, we wanted to give wide relief as far as values when we saw devastation on shelter belts and fences and that type of damage. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, under the statute, the guidelines, we are not able to do that. So it gave us a lot of heartburn and consternation. Sure. And we couldn't do that for the Betty's Way folks. So I cautioned folks in the room. I said, I'm not saying not to look at that and not saying not to file one, but just understand that your Board of Equalization is going to be limited in how much relief we can provide. So at any rate, it's a good time to talk to your county assessor's office. We have a great staff. We have in-house evaluators, appraisers. Those appraisers can walk the folks through all the process and can help identify what they can and cannot do as far as identifying the loss to the value. Okay. It's not as straightforward as you might think, Corey. You lose a fence, well,
yep.
The guidelines don't allow us to take that into consideration. Yep.
Unfortunately, that is the thing, and you have to make sure you comply with all those statutes.
Yeah, so. We don't have a choice. We'd love to do more, but we'll do what we can. We'd be glad to take a look at those forms.
Okay. He is Lincoln County Chairman of the Lincoln County Commissioners, Kent Weems. We appreciate you dropping by and look forward to chatting again next week.
Yeah, thanks, Corey.
Have a good week.